To continue today's Chinese New Year special, Omaha Public Radio presents a program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. We'll hear a discussion which took place following a screening of the 2007 documentary film Up the Yangtze, directed by Yong Chang. The film tells the story of the building of the Three Gorges Dam by the Chinese government on the Yangtze River from the point of view not only of the millions of people being displaced by the project, but also from the people on the last pleasure cruise up the river, including young Yu Shui, one of the people being displaced, but who is also working on the boat. Our guest during the discussion is the director of the film, Yong Chang. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, August 22, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now is our special guest, Yong Chang.
How many in the audience have been to the Yangtze River? There's always a few. Yeah, that's great. Good to see you. Yeah. And been to China?
Whoa.
我的妈. It's a lot of people. Good. Good. Well, it is a beautiful country, and there's a lot to see there, and I hope that this film helped to illuminate a little bit more of some of the nuances and complexities of that society. And it's not as easy as, you know, talking about things in black and white terms, and I think it's much more stimulating to look at those shades of gray, I think. Yes.
How long ago did you film it, and how long did it take to film?
I shot the film. Well, it took 4 years to research and develop the movie, and it took about a year of production in 2006. I shot over 200 hours of footage, in fact, and I followed numerous different subjects. And not only did I follow Yu Shui and Chimbuyu, but I followed about a handful. About seven total different crew workers on the boat. And over the course of shooting, I guess as a filmmaker, you sort of get a sense of who is becoming the stronger subject, and you focus on that. But it really did come down to about 8 months of post-production editing in 2007.
I love the film. It was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
How did you find that particular family? And how did you talk them into doing this?
Well, I'm lucky that I buddied up with the cruise company, which, just between you and me, is an American-managed company based in Woodside, Queens, New York. Mm-hmm. And they gave me permission, knowing full well the sort of film that I wanted to make, to work kind of carte blanche. And so through that process, I was able to join the cruise company on their recruitment trips when they went to all the local river towns in search of new employees. And lots of people like Yu Shui, like Chimbuyu, would sign up for an interview. And that's how I met my subjects in the beginning. And they were hired in the winter. And they didn't have to get on the boat to begin work until the summer. So I had a period of time where I could build the relationship, build that level of trust with every individual. And the minute I went back to visit Yu Shui's family, I knew that this was a very important centerpiece to the film, and especially the fact that we would bear witness to the effects of the flooding and the move. Her family's, I would say, an extreme example of poverty along the Yangtze River. And I think that the local government had a certain amount of sympathy for them. I mean, a lot of people were very systematically moved to higher location or different regions of the country, but I think that for this family in particular, they were allowed to remain to the bitter end before they had to move. When I began, when I started working with the family, the first thing I didn't do was bring a camera with me. The first thing I did was go alone and spend time with them to build that level of trust. And in the end, they really felt that that I was sort of like a big brother to Yu Shui, that I would be able to make sure she was all right when she left home for the first time to go work on this cruise ship. And that was sort of my role. I think that when the cameras are off, it's not just what you're filming, but what goes beyond that as well. Your interaction with the subjects is very important. Yes?
Did you experience any problems with the Chinese government?
I didn't. In fact, it was there was a couple things. First thing was that I worked with a Chinese film crew exclusively, and that was very, very important. They were professional filmmakers, documentary filmmakers from Beijing, and they really knew the climate and how to shoot, and they were sort of like my safety gauge in shooting the movie. In the beginning, I looked into the process of getting official permit, and I was advised by my Chinese crew not to do that. In fact, to shoot under the radar. And that's what I did. And I think with their help and a combination with me being Chinese, speaking Mandarin, it was sort of a unique perspective to be able to melt into the environment and to see both sides of the story, in a sense. It was an eye-opening experience. I mean, we would arrive in villages and towns, and I would we would pull out our camera, and people would actually come up to us to talk to us, thinking that we were from the local TV station, and that was very interesting, because it taught me that there is a climate to be able to talk about issues of corruption on the local level, environmental issues. That's not taboo, and people were very willing to discuss their issues, their problems with compensation, etc. So it taught me a lot. It taught me a lot about the reception to media, especially. I think it's different if a Western film crew were to come in and film. It would have been very different.
I'm curious if the family that this documentary focused on has seen your film, and if they have, what's their response to it? If they haven't, do you think that they will be able to see it?
Well, the first thing I did when I finished the film, and this was another something that I promised to the family and to myself, was that I wasn't going to walk away at the end of production and sort of disappear and make this film and you know, put the money in my pocket. It wasn't like that. And so the first thing I did when I finished the film was to go back to Chongqing and to show it to all of the subjects involved in the film. Yu Shui saw the movie, and she was... you can imagine, it's a very emotional experience to see yourself depicted in a documentary, sort of a surreal experience. She didn't know what to say to me, and a couple weeks later she wrote to me an email. And in this email she said that through the film she was able to see her fate and her destiny. Mm. And as a result she decided to leave the cruise boat and go back to high school. And so we stepped in as a production company to pay for the rest of her high school education. That was 3 years. And we've since also begun a fund for the family, a charity that I started. You can find it. Here's my plug. You can find this charity through the website upthyangzi.com. Click on this link, and I've started this this charity to help the family in the long term. I sort of my 5-year plan, and you know, the rest of the kids. There's 3 children. They need to go to high school as well, and there's a lot of other sort of everyday needs that the family requires. So I encourage you, if you feel so, to check out this website, and if you feel so, donate a few dollars to the family. We've almost reached our goal of a total of $25,000. We're shy a few thousand. And not only will the money go towards this family, but other subjects in my film as well, affected by the compensation process.
I noticed you had Werner Herzog in the special things.
Yeah, yeah.
Film kind of felt like a Herzog documentary. Did you have any conversations with him prior to filming, or?
Yeah, this is a nice little anecdote. In fact, I didn't meet him during production, but I was enamored by his films, especially films like Little Dieter Needs to Fly, and I had his book, which I highly recommend everyone, which is Herzog on Herzog, sort of my Bible. I had it strapped to my thigh during the production. And later I met him. I met him in Amsterdam at a festival called IDFA, a very good festival. And we had a conversation, and he asked me, did I find The Dancing Chicken? And that's a reference to one of his films where, much to the, I think, to the surprise of his crew, he decided to end his film Strosek, I think that's how you pronounce it, with the image of a prolonged image of a dancing chicken. And I guess it's sort of in his realm of what he calls an ecstatic truth. And I think that, and I told him, yeah, well, you know, I think I found that moment, and it was the dancing girl in the film. And in fact, I filmed that on my cell phone, and I found her in a club, in a nightclub, and it really did happen on the eve of the Autumn Moon Festival. She was there with her parents, and she was dancing wildly, and I was struck by that image, and I filmed it on this very black market phone that I bought in China. And you can come see me after, and I can show you the image on this. It's still with me.
Well, thanks for this film, and thanks for coming to Omaha. My question is, you are the director of the movie. How much you are able to direct, like the mother-daughter fight and other intimate scenes? Like, how do you go about filming those?
Right.
Staging those?
That's a good question. I mean, nothing is staged or scripted, and that's, I think, one of the beautiful things about documentary filmmaking is that it's very spontaneous. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know where the storylines are going to go. Keeps you on your toes. Those moments came across, I think, just through that process of building that relationship with all the individuals. In particular, the scene where the mother breaks down, that happened through a very, very, very simple question that I asked Yushui. And I asked her, did she know that her home was going to be flooded and that she would have to move? And she didn't know how to answer that. She asked her mother, and that out of that question came that scene. So I think that I think one has to be very open, very sensitive to the environment, to the moment, and I think be very receptive to kind of, as a director, I think what many people, documentary filmmakers, may say is that you don't really direct the film. In fact, your subjects direct you. You know what I mean? And I think it was like that for me.
I found, first of all, I want to say your grandfather's singing was beautiful. I thought that was a very, very good piece.
Thank you.
Also, a question. I found it very interesting, the references to, you know, some of the old stories, and obviously for everyone, mythology gives, you know, nature identity. And it seems, I found it, one of the quotes that one of the residents said about, you know, how even the dam is stopping the river, you know, the mighty river. What is becoming now the Yangtze's new identity, and is there any new mythology that is coming out about it that seems to be, you know, commonplace now?
Well, good question. I think it's too early to say at this point. I think that, I mean, even in Mao's poem, I think he envisioned this sort of new lake created out of this this reservoir, and I think that the future of the Yangtze River is much connected to the sort of commerce that is going to be opening up. And I think there's two. You can look at it in both sides. I think, on the other hand, pollution and the death of the river is something that is a concern for many people, even the locals. You know, recently, the last freshwater dolphin in the world was declared extinct, and it lived in the Yangtze River. So I think there are new mythologies coming out of that that region, but I think they enter more into the modern kind of context. And I should also mention that my grandfather, his entire album is available for download for free through my website. Yes, there's a question here. Yes.
Was Cindy's father able to tell many of the details about his family in the pre-revolutionary era that they lived in and how they were removed from their village?
Yeah, it's a very complicated story. In fact, the family, Yu family living in Chengdu, in fact, are illegal residents of that city because it's a sort of a tragic story. They were not eligible for compensation because they moved out of their hometown village, and just when the local officials from the relocation department came to give out the money, and they were not eligible, unfortunately. In terms of the history of the family, I did learn a lot about them, and somewhat discussed in the film. They were from a sort of, middle-class background. In fact, for a village, I would say, because the family was involved with government, and unfortunately, because of the Cultural Revolution, lost that position quite severely, and were put into a new sort of world, and had to become farmers and such. And that's sort of a common story across the board, I think, with a lot of families, even my family and their history as well.
You did a wonderful job showing the impact on that one family. I was wondering how many people were affected by the construction of that dam. How many people in total?
Well, the number is about 2 to 4 million now, and it's you know it's a very controversial sort of subject, and I mean I think the ultimate question is how do you put a monetary value on your ancestral homeland and farmland? I mean it's very very difficult. It's met with a lot of controversy. People, it was not uncommon for me to be traveling from location to A to location B and run into a protest in the middle of the highway, and I mean I did document, and it's also in the DVD extras, various other families. For example, I followed a village of protesters protesting the land development of their ancestral tombs because the local government wanted to build and relocate the new town on top of the sacred ground. I followed them to the point where they protested and blockaded a road to prevent the construction vehicles from coming in to raise the land. And they were able to renegotiate a contract, a settlement agreement. I would say that the central government was very efficient in the compensation process. People were moved to new locations, given new land, moved to entirely different regions of the country, given jobs in factories. But I think that ultimately is there does remain that ultimate question. You know, what do you how do you compensate millions of people? And I think one way of accepting that is, and I think one very clear truth that came out of it for me was that the Chinese are able to persevere and really, you know, their history is just, if you look at the history of China, it's a country of people that learn perseverance. And I think that often people do respect the government. They respect that that it is this sort of party line, a sacrifice to the bigger country, the bigger family. Yes.
Hello. Thank you again very much for giving me a different perspective. I was familiar more with some of the environmental concerns and historic site concerns. Mm-hmm. And I have a question related to that. Mm-hmm. Now that you've shown me how people are relocated and possibly their homes and lands, is there more of that continuance, like you said, even grave sites or historic being moved and protected? Or is that underwater?
I would say that, well, not everything could be protected, archaeologically speaking, historically speaking. But they did, the relocation process also did, for example, there was, and some of you that have been to the Yangtze River may know that there's a Shibozai temple built on the side of a mountain, and that has been protected by a dike around the perimeter. It's become an island, in fact. And so a lot of major archaeological sites have been protected. There's the White Crane Rock in Fuling, and that in fact it's already been submerged. But the local government built an underground sort of museum protecting the White Crane Rock, which is a very historic, very very important landmark. And unfortunately, they ran out of funds to complete the project, but it's sitting there underground, under the river. But I think numerous sites and historic sites were inundated. Sort of a Chinese thing, I think, that Chinese history is always about moving forward, I would say. There's a saying, kingdoms rise and fall, nations come and go. And I think that's kind of encompasses how the Chinese view history.
Several years ago, we had an opportunity to visit China, and we're hiking up towards this Tiger Leaping Gorge.
Yeah, the Tiger Leaping Gorge. Yeah.
And we encountered a whole town that was being constructed. Was this the type of setting where they might move some of these people?
It's possible. I know that at one point they were considering damming the Three Tiger Leaping Gorge, in fact. And because of the issues that arose out of the Three Gorges Dam project, they've since halted that engineering endeavor, and it's possible. I mean, I think that most people relocated near their hometowns that were being inundated. In the extreme case, people were shipped to Guangzhou province or Shanghai, for example. Some people ask me what happened to Jerry, and I would say that he saw the film, and he wished that there could have been more of him in the documentary. When I was at Sundance, a woman asked me, you know, where is Jerry? And someone in the audience stood up and said that she just was on another farewell cruise trip and that Jerry is now working on that boat and that she tipped him very well.
You've been listening to a discussion which followed a screening at Film Streams of the 2007 documentary film Up the Yangtze, directed by Yong Chang. Our guest was the director of the film. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday evening, August 22, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.